People often say to me, you've got good hands. And what I think is that I've got good eyes. I think that my hands are always going to be limited by what I can see.
Hello, welcome to the Dental Head Start podcast, where we help dental students become great dentists. I'm your host, David Keir, and this episode we have a dental legend. Dr. Tony Rotondo comes on the show to share his story and his tips with the community. Tony is an exceptional clinician. Most of us know his work from his posts on Facebook. If you're in the Facebook group DPR, then you'll know the background. That smile was created with composite by Tony, and I think it's just exceptional. How he did that is actually on a website, step by step, and I'm going to put that in the show notes. I recommend everybody checks it out to understand how he created that amazing smile. Tony is a prosthodontist working in Brisbane and the Gold Coast. He has a particular interest in aesthetics and working with precision to the highest level. He's quite a critic of his own work, and I think that's what it's allowed him to get to where he is. And in this podcast, we talk about the steps he's taken to evolve his clinical practice. He gives us some tips on improving and following that same path. He talks about working with the lab, and he talks about photography, something he does as a hobby as well as clinically, both of which he does to a high standard, and his precision really shows. We also talk a little bit about CPD and what to do at the early on to help you take steps forward, as well as a little bit about the courses he runs with Dr. Michael Mandakos with CEO Dental. I really hope you enjoy this interview. I certainly did, and it's a pleasure talking with Tony. He's a genuine, humble guy who does want to help others and share his experience. If you do appreciate this, as always, I genuinely just want you to do one thing for me, which is to share this with other dental friends. Pop it in your story, send them a message, or just chat in conversation. Bring this up. If it's going to help other people, I appreciate you let them know. But for now, let's get to the chat with Dr. Tony Rotondo. So Tony, it's a pleasure to sit down and have this chat. You're really well known in the dental community, and you're someone that you do amazing work. And to a young graduate, it's something that really, it's hard to imagine how you even got there. So I'm looking forward to having this chat. And we actually met last year, and it was a pleasure chatting with you and finding you genuinely humble and willing to share. So thank you for spending the time with me on Dental Head Start podcast.
Pleasure to be asked, David. Looking forward to the conversation.
I want to learn a bit about your early influences. Your dad was a dentist, is that right?
Yeah, my dad was a dentist in North Queensland, so he was a general practitioner in a small country town. I don't think there was anything especially remarkable about his practice except that it was a busy general practice. And, I suppose more than anything, Dad was an especially nice person. And I don't know. He seemed to contribute a lot to the local community. I mean, people seem to remember him very fondly. Certainly I do. And I don't know. You might be aware that there's this lecture in North Queensland that they call the Tony Rotondo Memorial Lecture, and that's after Dad. And what's interesting about that is that, you know, on the face of it, his history was fairly unremarkable. It's just that someone decided at some point in time that he, was someone who stood for something good, and they wanted to turn that into a lecture and a medal. So
he clearly had a big impact on a lot of people for that to be the case.
Yeah, look, a lot of people in a small community, and then one or two dentists in that small community, particularly a guy called Dominic Ponti, seized on that a little bit. He had a lot of patients that would come and visit him and talk fondly of Dad, and perhaps Dad's reputation built large for him. Maybe larger than it should have been. I don't know, but he was someone who wanted to start some education in North Queensland, and later approached me and said, "Do you mind if we?" Use your dad's name?" And of course, I was really, very excited about that. So the lecture itself has nothing to do with me, except that, of course, it's named after my father, and for me, that's a really nice thing.
So, was dentistry always in your blood? Obviously, it was in the family. Did you always want to become a dentist?
I don't think so. I think up until my second last year of school, I probably didn't want to do dentistry, and I didn't have, while I liked my father very much, I didn't have a lot of exposure to his dental practice. And at some point, I felt at the time quite independent of him. I decided that I wanted to do something where I worked with people and used my hands. And dentistry seemed to tick that box, and that's why I decided to do it. But you know, God knows how much subliminal influence my father being a dentist had on me. I don't really know.
Yeah, of course. Were your memories of being in a family where your father was a dentist, were they positive memories? Like, for the profession, for him, was a good thing? And do you think that might have sent you that way?
For sure. So he, he enjoyed his work. He enjoyed his, his position in the local community. You know, he was kind of a, for want of a better word, a respected elder or something. So generally, my impression was that he really enjoyed it. So you're right, that must have been some sort of influence for me. Though the actual dentistry that he did was something that I wasn't exposed to a lot.
Yeah, it's interesting how these influences can subliminally, lead us a certain way and we don't even realise. So you said you're in North Queensland. So you grew up in North Queensland. How was school and how'd you find yourself at uni?
Okay, so I went to a boarding school, a Catholic boarding school in Brisbane called Nudgee College. So we would fly down every year. Actually, I got a funny story to tell with that. So I was supposed to go to boarding school in grade 8, and I remember at the time my parents, they bought my school uniforms and they bought my books, and at the last minute they felt that I was too young to go and they didn't want to get a plan and send me off. So they called the principal up and said, would it be okay if I came in grade 9? And the principal said, look, that's not something that can really happen. We can't reserve a place. You know, if he gives it up, then that's it. And anyway, the local archbishop, or the Archbishop of Queensland at the time, was a guy called Frank Rush, who was the parish priest in Ingham, my hometown, for 15 years. And he married Mum and Dad, and Dad used to treat all the clergy for free. So he called the archbishop up, who was a good friend of his, and 2 days later, I was in the school in grade 9, and that's not the funny part of the story. The funny part of the story is that every term from grade 9 on, there would be a dozen kids from North Queensland that would arrive in Brisbane on a plane, and we'd hop in 3 or 4 cabs and go out to my boarding school. But whoever was in my cab had to take a detour. And the cab would stop outside this big old house, and I'd jump out of the cab, knock on the door, and someone would open the door, and I'd hand them this brown paper bag, and then I'd jump back in the car. And in the brown paper bag was a freshly caught frozen barramundi, which I would have to do with the Archbishop every turn. Anyway, it's a bit of
that was the payment.
It's a bit of an Italian Catholic North Queensland story.
it's quite something quite valuable that you were transporting there. I can imagine he would have appreciated that very much. So you did start at the boarding school in sorry?
He liked his barra.
Yeah, I bet. North Queensland barra. It's pretty special. So you did start boarding school in year 9, was it?
Yes.
All right. And so I went through school, and then you said about 2 years before you finished, you thought, all right, I am going to go towards dentistry. You studied at UQ dentistry. How did you find uni?
I loved uni. I had a fantastic time at uni. In fact, I probably didn't do very much work at uni. I was more of a social animal, but, I had a wonderful time. I enjoyed dental school, but I probably didn't excel at dental school. You know, I think my GPA was like somewhere between 4.5 and 5. It wasn't, it wasn't bad, but it wasn't exceptional. So
it seems to be quite common where you get through university and then you find your passion later on, and that's where you start to really excel when you dive into what you're actually passionate about.
I think that's very true for me. Yeah.
So you graduated UQ, general dentist. How were your first couple of years?
My first job was in the United Kingdom. So 4 or 5 of my colleagues hopped on a plane on the New Year's Eve that we finished dental school and started work in the UK. So it was interesting because, you know, I mean, quite famously, dentistry in the United Kingdom at that point in time was fairly primitive and fairly sort of quick, I guess. There was a broad range of dental practices, some of which were really very bad and others of which, you know, were getting close to good, but quite making it. But, yeah, so I went there. The first practice that I worked in was particularly primitive. I remember it was in an attic at the very top of a building, and there was a chair that was broken, so it was only lying down. It couldn't sit up, so I would have to step over the top of the chair to get to my seat, and I couldn't get out of my seat unless I either stepped over the patient or the patient wasn't there. And I remember at that time we weren't using gloves. Like, gloves sort of came to existence with the sort of whole HIV thing, which happened a couple of years later. And all the sterilization that existed was sort of, at that particular practice, was cold sterilization. So I'd use some instruments. I'd put them in a Tupperware container with a cold sterilizing solution in them, and then I would pick them back out of that container. So it was really,
it's changed a lot.
Retrospect, yeah.
Certainly changed a lot. Was it actually quite different to Australian dentistry at that time, like the like those standards? So okay, so it was quite a shock.
I remember Australian dentists saying things like if someone went to the United Kingdom and worked, that they would be reluctant to employ them when they came back because they felt that the dentistry was a little bit too quick. And
so, what drove you over to the UK early on?
I think, like I said, I was a bit of a social animal, and it was just something I wanted to do from a purely self-indulgent kind of travel, have an experience abroad perspective. My dad, interestingly, did the same thing in the late 1940s, so I guess I'd heard that story, and that might have also influenced me a little bit.
That would have been quite pioneering in the 1940s, I would think.
Yeah.
Did you enjoy that experience, and do you think that added to who you are now?
For sure. I mean, it was great. Dentistry was, I suppose, quicker in that environment. So I think you had to work out what compromises you were prepared to make, and I think you had to think hard about what you were doing to make it work. And I think it was not a completely bad system, in that a lot of people received some, you know, very well-priced dentistry, but it was certainly open to abuse. So for me, the challenge was to do something reasonable within the timeframes that we had, and I think that was quite possible. Certainly, I saw a lot of things that and got a lot of experience that maybe I wouldn't have gotten if I was in Australia at that time.
Sounds like the story a lot of people have if they've gone and worked in the NHS. It's quite different to, say, a private practice job in Australia at this current climate, that's for sure. Did you have a good mentor when you got out of uni?
Probably a few different people at different times. So the first practice that I described in the United Kingdom, I only lasted in for a couple of months. And second practice I worked in was a much, much nicer practice, and it was run by an Australian guy called Bill Roberts, who passed away about a decade or so ago. But, I mean, terrific guy, really nice fellow who I suppose helped me find the right balance. I mean, he was an ethical practitioner who was, had a very practical and ethical interpretation of what could happen in that system.
I can imagine you'd burn out quite quick if you were exposed to someone who was the opposite of that.
For sure. And
it would demoralize you.
There were plenty of opposites, and there were people, as you said, that kind of burned out. And then I guess after that, when I was working back in Brisbane, I worked in for a health fund for a period. It was one of the first, I suppose, health fund type clinics, and it was the Queensland Teachers Health Union, and that was run by an exceptionally ethical dentist, a guy called Arthur Toohey, and I think I got a lot to be grateful for him, because I think I was a reasonably competent dentist at that time, and he would get me to do some of the more tricky cases. I mean, you know, they probably weren't too tricky in retrospect, but I certainly felt that they were sort of demanding.
It's all relative.
Yeah, that's right. And so he was really encouraging and supportive, and there I probably got to do some, you know, I won't say larger cases, but cases in that sort of moderate range that I probably wouldn't have had access to before. And you know, he was good at sort of guiding me through that process. So he was definitely a big influence. And interestingly, he's 93 now, and I'm his dentist, so I get to see him fairly often, which is really nice.
That is nice to keep in touch with those mentors. They certainly shape you. You said you you had a, I guess, an affinity from it from the start. So you had good hands for dentistry.
I think you're right. I think my hands were pretty good. And it's funny. People often say to me, "You've got good hands." And what I think is that I've got good eyes. I think that my hands are always going to be limited, but by what I can see,
and I think
that I've been lucky enough to train myself to see a lot of detail that not everyone sees, and you can't do something with your hands unless you can see it first. And so probably over a maybe a 10 or 15 year period, I don't know. I guess I trained myself to look hard at things.
That makes a lot of sense. And I remember hearing the first time someone said you can't treat what you can't see. Diagnosis and treatment planning is so much more, well, not more important, but it's the foundation. You can't have anything else without having correct diagnosis, or everything you do is wrong. And you can't treat something if you can't understand it. For instance, if you're not seeing wear patterns,
the problem is what to look for. You're right.
Yeah, yeah. Do you have any advice for graduates? Do you think, and we'll get a lot into advice for graduates, a real key theme that I like to bring through my podcast, but in the concept of not being able to see or missing things, are there things that spring to mind that young dentists or inexperienced dentists miss?
Well, I don't know whether this is going to answer your question completely, but it's on the same idea of having a good vision and being able to see. I think a problem that a lot of people have is they don't see detail. And I often say to people that if your interest is in restorative dentistry, that you need to become a student of morphology, because all a restorative dentist really does is alter the morphology of teeth. So whether you're doing a little filling or a crown, or whether that's you know, becoming six anterior teeth that you're working on, or replacing an entire occlusion, it's about altering the shape of a tooth or a number of teeth or all of someone's teeth. And so to be able to do that really well, you need to understand really well how teeth are shaped. And I think in a digital world, it may appear that you don't need to understand morphology as well, because the computer can do it all. But I think the more you understand that detail, the more you'll understand how to manipulate the tools, whether they're computers or CAD/CAM machines or printers, to get sort of really nice results. So from the outset, looking closely at natural teeth always, and tuning into the little details, and listening to what people point out, you know, that for me is a kind of a lifelong learning process. It never stops.
Mm. That's really interesting. I think it's something it's not a failure of the uni at all, but I don't feel I fully we did morphology so early that I don't feel that was really ingrained enough, and we didn't do many wax ups, and we didn't you know, make our own crowns or anything like that. So I think it's something that was definitely missing, and something that can certainly help. Something I'm looking to do and haven't actually done is a waxing course. Or something along those lines to help me get, you know, my head around that a bit better. So that's good advice.
That's a really good idea. A waxing course is a great way to start to become familiar with morphology. And I think you're right. I think universities do miss that a lot. And probably it's because the people that are running those programs aren't as restoratively oriented as they could perhaps be, to focus on biology and prevention, and that's great, because we should be sort of medical people, but sometimes it comes at the expense of something else that's important.
That's right. Well, bringing someone who's essentially, you know, just the public to become a dentist within 4 years or 5 years as an undergraduate degree is a pretty big step. So I always think, look, they do a good job within their confines, but it's very much confined, and a graduate needs to recognize that and recognize their learning doesn't stop. And I think anyone listening to this recognizes that too. So you had an affinity for the restorative side pretty early on, by the sounds of it. How did that then evolve into becoming a prosthodontist?
I think the next step for me was I at a fairly young age, I organised a couple of courses with a German dental technician who was in Brisbane, and that gave me some exposure to some really great dentists of that period. Two standout people would have been Jerry Sheesh, who's a prosthodontist from Louisiana, well, originally from Louisiana, now I think he's in Georgia. He's a French guy. And a dental technician or a ceramist called Klaus Muttertees. Most people have heard of Willy Geller. I mean, most of the dental technicians in the world would have heard of Klaus Muttertees. He would have been one of the two real pioneers of that time. Those were guys that were capable of doing extraordinary work. So I saw some really extraordinary things, and I suddenly realized that these crowns that we were doing didn't have to look like white blobs. They could actually look like teeth. And so I think, let's say 4 or 5 or 6 years into my career, I started to obsess over that, trying to make teeth look better. And you have to remember it was sort of pre-internet. So, I'd look at a book or an advertisement from a porcelain manufacturer. Those were the only resources in terms of seeing photographs of nice work. So that generated an interest. Then I started my own dental practice, and I suppose when your income depends on what you're doing, then maybe you start to become more motivated again. And then my father died when I was 27. And I went from a life where I was just this spoiled kid running around doing exactly what I wanted to someone actually be a little bit responsible at work and know that there was no one there to look after me. So that meant that suddenly I had to do a bunch of work for some years. And I think after about 3 years of that, I just wanted an excuse to run away. And doing a prosthodontic program gave me a reason to escape for a little while.
So you owned your own practice before, as a general dentist, before doing the specialist program?
Correct.
Would you say you found yourself burnt out?
No, the opposite. I might have been a little bit burnt out from the family responsibilities that I didn't have before my father died, but I wasn't burnt out from dentistry. I was really enjoying that, and I was enjoying watching my practice evolve. And I did have more of an interest in restorative dentistry than anything else. And I think many general dentists, like myself at that time, probably wonder why a prosthodontist might be better than them. So I'm sitting there looking at my crowns thinking, I've got good impressions, I did good preps, what is it that's so different about my crown compared to the local prosthodontist's crowns? And of course, it's not the crown, it's more about a way of looking at a case. But still, you wonder those things, and you know that there are some big gaps in your knowledge. And so for me, the idea of becoming a prosthodontist and knowing everything, that's a joke, by the way. Prosthodontists don't know everything, but there's this notion that you might be able to learn so much more.
Yeah.
So it sort of made sense for me to try and do something. So then I think it was in the early 1990s, I applied to a few programs and got into one and then did that.
Mm. So you traveled early on and then you traveled again. You did your pros program at UCLA. How was that?
Good. I mean, I think when you hear those words, UCLA, it sounds like a really great university. And once again, if you talk to people that want to do prosthodontics and people that have completed a prosthodontic program, you'll see very quickly that there are two different, notions about what happens in a prosthodontic program. Someone that wants to enter a pros program is wanting to be mentored, is wanting to exit that program being immediately great somehow, mm-hmm. and is thinking yeah, very much
completely that changed.
They do, yeah. That's what they'll get. You know, it's but someone that's just done a pros program knows that you know there is no mentor. You don't get the support that you're hoping for. You don't come out great. but what you do go through is a program of learning where a series of hurdles are put in front of you, and you probably couldn't acquire that knowledge by yourself. I mean, you might be able to, but it would be very difficult. So UCLA was like that. I mean, in some respects, it was a letdown because you're expecting, you know, to have that mentor. And in fact, I went to UCLA because there was a guy called John Sorensen there at the time, who is now a good friend of mine. But he announced that he would be leaving the day that I arrived. So that was a little bit for me. So my mentor vanished almost immediately. So there were some disappointments, but in the end, there was a lot of hard work. And UCLA is in a big city with a lot of good dentists, so there was a lot of exposure to, you know, good education. But it wasn't fancy. It was just hard work, really.
Yeah. And that's the story I tend to hear from most people, either in or through specialist programs, is you get what you put in, and, you know, it doesn't necessarily turn you into someone great unless you continue to focus and take yourself there. Yeah. Through that program, obviously you've come a long way since then. Do you think you had all that attention to detail and precision then, or has that evolved much more in your later years?
I think I probably had it then. Actually, because I was really influenced by some of those earlier people that I'd had exposure to, and I remember when I did my program, I'd been a general practitioner for 10 years, and I knew that when I came out of the program, I needed to be able to let people know what I did so that hopefully someone would refer me some work. So I thought the best thing for me to do would be to try and complete my cases to a reasonably high standard, and that maybe I could put together some sort of talk about the cases that I did in my program. So we had to do all of our own lab work, and this for me was a huge learning experience, one of the best learning experiences of my entire life. So I set about doing some ceramic courses outside of the university. So I did one with a guy called Robert Winter, who was a really excellent ceramist and prosthodontist. I did a ceramics course with Klaus Muttertees, the German guy I was talking about, and a couple of others along the way. So the lab work that I was doing, I was trying to do, you know, to the best level I could. I mean, it took me hours to make one crown because I didn't have those skills. But it might have taken me 8 hours to make a crown. But they ended up, you know, for someone at my level, they were you know, it was reasonably good work. So I think that's true, and it's probably the feedback I got from other people in the program. Yeah. So I think, you know, if there was a place where I developed that attention to detail, that was the place, and doing that lab work, that was.
Yeah. Okay. And do you think you learn a lot of your morphology from that lab work as well?
For sure. Yeah. No doubt about it. For sure. I learned about color from that guy Bob Witter and Klaus,
yep.
And shape, you know, also probably from those two guys and doing my own lab work. And I think I was probably, I mean, without trying to oversell myself, I was probably one of the first people in the world, there might have been two or three others, but to make composite start to look a little bit more real.
Yeah.
And the other people like, and I don't mean to compare myself to the other people because they're much greater than me. There's like a guy called Lorenzo Vanini and Didier Dicci. I mean, they probably came from a more restorative background, but for me, I had learnt everything from dental technicians and from doing ceramics, and I was just trying to apply that same information to using, you know, with respect to using composite resins.
That was exactly my next question. You feel that has been brought forward into your composite work, and I imagine your advice would be the same thing around morphology and shape to allow graduates to do better composite work.
For sure.
Do you have any advice for that kind of thing? It's a bit off a tangent, but for composite work, taking those steps forward. So, for instance, obviously learning shape and potentially doing courses on that kind of thing. Any other advice that springs to mind?
few things. I mean, doing those different composite courses that different people hold, that they're essentially exercises in shape and colour, so they're good things to do. The other thing I would say is photograph your work, because you will inevitably be your own worst and best critic. Photographs are horribly truthful critics. So,
you see them with different eyes when you see a photo.
For sure. You see the problems that you don't see clinically, you see in the photograph. So you look at something clinically, you think you're a hero, you take a photograph of it, you have a close look at it, and you realize what a mug you really are. Yeah. And
I've experienced that.
Everyone has. And even now, I see, I do four cases. Three of them I think are going to be great. I look at the photos and I'm a little bit disappointed, and then one I get a little bit lucky with and it looks okay.
Yeah, yeah. So photography seems to be a passion of yours. Did your clinical photography come first, or you do a bit of hobby landscape photography as well? Which came first?
I think clinical photography first. I think I was always a little bit interested, in amateur photography. Like I was always, trying to take a slightly more interesting photo, but it was probably a passing interest. And so the clinical photography I became quite obsessed with. Like the first question I would always ask those early dental technicians that I worked with was what camera they were using, what flash they were using. The same questions that everyone asked me. And so I became, obsessed with taking a good photograph clinically, and then I'd just gone a few holidays. I've probably got Facebook to thank for my interest in landscape.
Yeah.
Because I'd take a few photos on a trip, I'd put them up, people would say a few nice things, and then I would try to take better photos on the next. And so you become your own worst enemy. But it is a really nice interest that I've been lucky enough to develop. It's probably my only true hobby.
And would you say, that is your hobby at the moment, and it's something that it drives you or takes you traveling? Or
love it, yeah.
Is it a big part?
It drives my family's travel quite a bit, which is a little bit selfish.
Yeah.
It's cool to some nice places, so.
Yeah, got to go to a nice landscape to get the good photo. Yeah.
I'll show some photos to my wife. I'll say, look at this place. It's amazing, blah, blah, blah. Why don't we go there? And, she'll either can it or let me go.
That sounds like a good way to do it. It's perfect, really. Yeah. So, your photography is skills. How did you gain most of those skills? Because your photography, I've always noticed, or your presentation of cases online is exceptional. It's artistic. It's there's precision in everything you do. Something I also noticed and I commend you for is you always talk about and name the lab or the ceramist who you work with as well. Yeah. And I think that's something that's really important, because they have such a big impact on our work. If we're using a ceramist, someone like yourself, you can get your outcomes because of that. So like the two-part question, I guess, you're the aesthetic or the art side, do you feel that comes from your photography, your hobby photography, and into your dentistry?
The photo question first. I think I've always had a kind of a loose interest in graphics and design, and I think all of those things, actually, if I look at all of those things, graphic design, photography, and dentistry, one thing that they probably all have in common is this whole art and science idea, the idea that there are some artistic elements and some scientific elements. Certainly dentistry, at least the sort of dentistry that I practice, is very much tied up with that. If I look at photography, it's also the same. There's some artistic elements where your composition, for example, that's not science, but, the lens you use, the aperture and the speed and the sensor, that's all science. So once again, it's a nice combination of both of those things. And then I think with graphics, it's a little bit the same. So with dental photography, I like to present my cases in a lifelike but pretty way. So I would like to think, and I'm happy to be criticized, but I'd like
that certainly comes through in your presentation.
I'd like to think that, I mean, you know, some people use illumination that's a little bit too soft, and the image is, you know, it's almost a way of hiding your dentistry. And then other people probably aren't, you know, using harsher light, and they have beautiful work, but it doesn't maybe look its best. I'm trying to get that balance right, where people can see my work, where I'm not trying to hide it, but it looks nice too. And so, you know, maybe that's something that I've had. It's not difficult to do, but it's probably something I've had a bit of time to develop. And then it's nice if your images look somewhat consistent. You know, from certainly within the one case, but maybe across all of your cases. And I guess when I'm, putting together a few images for something online, I actually enjoy placing or orienting them in a way that somehow looks, you know, attractive. And I think I'm hoping that it might make for a better message or a better lesson or something as well.
Well, it certainly tells a story, and if it's aesthetic, more people look at it, it's a good way to do it. I've always been very impressed by what I see in that regard.
The second thing you mentioned, and I don't want to skip it, is that I like to mention the ceramists and technicians that I work with. You know, I just think that's only fair. It is, you know, restorative dentistry is often, prosthodontics in particular, is often truly a collaboration, and you know, certainly with respect to Sabi in Perth, you know, we're lucky enough to have a really great collaboration, and you know, I just learn so much from Sabi every year. I probably learn more from dental technicians than I do from dentists, and of all the dental technicians, I've learnt the most from Sabi. And his work is extraordinary. He puts his heart and soul into every case, and he makes me look good every day. So I couldn't not acknowledge him and the other people that I work with.
Of course, and that's quite admirable. But it's absolutely right. Like they do create the beautiful final product. Where as a prosthodontist, you allow it to happen, and they create that as well. So it is a team. I think that's really good. So you said they're someone who really teaches you a lot. In what ways do you feel you're still learning around that, would you say?
Well, in the very beginning, let's say when I was working, like in the late 80s, at the beginning of my career, I remember just at that health fund that I was working with, there was a lab right next door, and I was working with a ceramist that I worked with for many, many years, a guy called Bath Terrian, and I would often ask him to look at my preps and say, you know, how could I improve this? And so from the very beginning, I learned a lot about tooth preparations, about you know, areas that I was missing, places that I could improve, where I wasn't reducing enough tooth structure, where I was reducing too much. So immediately at that point, I was learning a lot from them. And then you could ask why. You know, why do you need more space in this area, and why do you need more space in that area, and why can't we do it like this, and why can't we do it like that? Then I think, you know, those lessons on shape and colour, you know, they all came from either dental technicians or prosthodontists with a really significant interest in shape and colour. And then with Sabi, you know, every day there's, you know, every case is different, and every day we're seeing problems. So we'll you know, fabricate some provisionals or try something in, and I'll see some problems, and we'll take some photographs, and we'll get on the phone together, or maybe we'll exchange a few texts, and I'll say, you know, what can we do about this, or what can we do about that? And he'll say, well, maybe if I alter the shape of the tooth in this way or that way, that could kind of resolve that problem. So
so communication's a really big thing.
And repeated over many, many years with different people, and maybe that's when you start to see and understand some of the details that other people maybe aren't seeing or understand, or younger people maybe aren't seeing or understanding. I don't know. build up because
so that cultivating that relationship with your lab tech obviously can really improve your own dentistry.
For sure.
Do you have any advice that I'm not sure, because I know you have, you know, these really strong relationships with your lab technicians, but a lot of dentists graduate into an associateship where they don't have as much choice potentially. What is your advice on cultivating the lab tech relationship and getting the most from it, particularly if it's not someone you can just go and see, so they're remote?
It's difficult because all relationships take time. You know, there's no such thing as a relationship without time. And the more time you have, the more evolved the relationship becomes. And, you know, some of those relationships are going to lead to a really good place, and other of those relationships are going to kind of fall short for whatever reason. Maybe it could be the dentist's fault, it could be the technician's fault, it might be no one's fault, because relationships are dynamic. You know, they depend on two different people. But so I guess the first thing is, let's say you're in that situation where you don't have as much control over the lab that you're sending work to. I think the first thing to do is to talk. I don't like texts so much. I actually hate typing and paper. and I just think that texts and emails are really easy to interpret. Like, I know that if I get a job from the lab back and I don't like it and I send the lab card back, you know, there'll be a few short words that I've written underneath it, you know, which probably wouldn't be the nicest thing to hear for a technician that's slaved over a particular case. So I think that'll work a whole lot better if you pick up the phone. The first thing I'd say is try to develop a relationship with whoever it is that you're working with. The chances are they'll really appreciate it, and the chances are that they'll send you better work because of it. The other thing that I would say is photograph your work and send the technician or ceramist that you're working with photographs of their work, because once again, those guys slave over something in the lab, and they never get anything back. They never get to see how their work looks in the mouth. They never get any feedback. They can't improve without the feedback. And if you're the one guy of the 10 people that they're working with that's sending back the odd photo, I can promise you you'll get, more effort from that person that you're working with. So that's the first thing. And then, once again, it's just about pursuing individuals that you think you could work with and just testing those relationships and seeing how they go.
No, that's excellent advice. And I guess it all comes back. Photography and photographing your own work, it lets you assess it. But if your technician doesn't actually get to see their own work, it's hard for them to self-analyze. So that's an excellent piece of advice, obviously.
It's like a chef and not seeing anyone enjoy your meals.
Not tasting your own food. That's a really good point. So with your career, you've obviously come to be known as someone who, one of the best dentists or prosthodontists in Australia, I would say. And some of your composite work in particular is absolutely immaculate. The background for the DPI, everyone knows that background. You did that with your hands and composite. And for many of us, me included, I can't even understand how that's possible, although I have actually seen the step-by-step photos. Tell us about the journey that got you there. Like, what do you think were the pivotal things that you've done over your career to get you to this point?
Actually, the first thing I need to address is that idea of being the best. Like, I think that I have there are particular skills that I have that are really very good that might be occasionally worthy of that description. For example, my composite work, I put a lot of energy into that over a long period of time. But you know, there are probably lots of other areas where I'm not so strong at. I'm not great at pathology and pharmacology. There are a whole host of other areas that within prosthodontics that I lack a little interest in. So
you're certainly humble as well, which I think a lot of people.
I definitely don't have the whole thing covered. So but with respect to what you are saying, I think probably we've already talked about it a little bit. Like fairly early, probably starting just before my pros program, and then maybe it was really consolidated within my pros program. I started to become quite obsessed with making teeth look like teeth, and looking and copying and looking and copying and photographing and looking and copying and photographing and looking and copying and listening to someone else speak and then looking and copying and repeating those processes over and over again until I got better and better at it, and looking at my my own results and critiquing them and thinking, oh, God, if I could only have put a couple of scratches in those few places or got rid of those couple of scratches, that would have looked so much better again. So I think it's being interested in it, which I was, from a relatively early period, and then being put in an environment where that was somehow nurtured and encouraged a little bit, and then being interested in it enough to pursue it. I think most people probably just aren't as interested in it. I think you are, because I saw those those aesthetic diagrams that you did with that case, and you can only do that if you're looking at something and analyzing it and thinking about it. And I probably did similar things in different ways at stages throughout my career, and it's that constant repetition and trying harder that.
Well, to get to a level where you're at, it's like that. People think, not instant success, but you come out with these amazing cases. It's not instant. It's 40 or 30 years of hard work. It's self-assessment. It's little micro improvements that get you there. So it's certainly impressive, but we've got to remember the background behind it and the effort, I'm sure, and the dedication to it as well, as a long period of time.
I think one thing that's interesting is that with the internet and that kind of explosion of dental photographs that are all over people's Instagram and Facebook pages these days, that access to that information has never been better. And I see people, I see young people doing really good work much more rapidly. So I think that learning curve that I described before, I think it's, I think people are getting to an end point in a quicker period of time now, just because of the availability of information.
Yeah, you were saying you used to refer to the leaflet that might come or a few little pieces of information here and there. Nowadays we can get thousands of images instantly. In fact, we get bombarded with it, and sometimes you could argue too much, making some people feel a bit bad about their own work, which is not how it should be. But it's definitely out there, and it's definitely allowing people to see what's possible.
Yeah.
And take those steps to improvement.
That's a good point, that it can have two effects. One effect is to provide a source of inspiration, which everyone needs. But the other thing is that it can be demoralizing, and I'm certainly guilty of not showing my failures and worst cases online, and that's a problem. I have to say that one thing I really like about DPR in that Australian environment is that it is a place where it seems to me that people can talk about more real world issues, and I think that's really important, and I don't think I'm helping that at all, but I do think it's really, really important.
Yeah, it certainly is important. Those communities, or having any kind of community around you, is so important for support. Even if it's your own close friends in dentistry, you really do need that, not to feel isolated. I think that's really, really important thing. You brought up something I'd love to actually ask you a little bit about. So we see a lot of your exceptional cases. That's great, and it's just exceptional work. You mentioned sometimes you take a few photos or a few cases, and some you're not quite as happy about. What proportion of your work are we seeing, would you say?
Look, I tend to post something once a month or so. So I guess what you're seeing is the best case that I've delivered that month. Let's say that, 15 cases are completed in a month, then I guess it's 1 in 15 or something.
Tell us about your experience with failure, because we all have failure, and I think it's important for people to understand, you know, someone like yourself still have situations where, you know, they're not up to potentially your standard or what have you. Tell us a bit about your experience with that.
Okay. There are different types of failures, and maybe I'll start from the less severe to the more severe, but you know, one type of failure is that I'm looking at a case that I think was going to be fantastic for posting, and you know, there are a couple of dings in the composite in the wrong places, and so I decided
to
post that. Well, that's not a failure. That's just
no, definitely not
being vain.
Well, I was going to bring up soon a perfectionist streak, perhaps.
Yep, maybe something like that. And then maybe the next type of failure might be a case that you kind of knowingly maybe didn't do to the highest standard because you knew that you could keep the patient happy with a lesser result. I guess as long as that case does keep the patient happy and fulfills the requirements of health and function, then that's probably not a failure either. That's just you're not putting as much effort in as you could have, and that's kind of about you. And the next type of failure is where maybe the patient's not happy with a result and you are. That's really difficult to manage because maybe that's the most difficult one because you kind of feel like you've done your best, but you feel that objectively the case is really very good, but you're not seeing things the same way that the patient is. That's one of the hardest things to manage. So then you have to start saying to the patient, well, the only way I can help you now is to just do what you tell me to do. And the problem with that is that, you know, I don't necessarily agree with it. And so then you have to ask yourself whether it's something that you can do or not. So that's a really tricky one. I don't have a great solution to it. No. And the other failures are where things break or don't work or don't come together the way both you and the patient were hoping. I think that it's true that the more you know and the more careful you are, the less of those you will experience. But it's inevitable that you will experience those failures because, you know, that's what happens in dentistry. Things fail for one reason or another. Mm. And I guess then it's about managing the patient and maybe yourself. You know, am I going to kind of redo some stuff for free? And I mean, typically I would do that if it was within a certain time frame and have another go at thing. And then the other thing I guess you've got to hope is that you inform the patient from the outset of the likelihood of those failures so that they're okay when and if they do happen. I mean, no one's ever completely okay, but yeah.
Yes, of course. No one wants to go through dentistry twice.
No.
Not many of our patients particularly want to be in our chair either. So. Yeah, that's exactly right. So, would you say you're a perfectionist?
It's really weird. I think I'm a perfectionist in some areas and not in others. Like I think there are some things I can't let go of and have to do to a fairly high standard, but I am really good at, you know, if I do finish work at 5 or 6 o'clock at night, I'm pretty good most of the time at walking out the door and not really thinking or worrying about it at all. And it's interesting, like, I might worry about a scratch on some composite resin, but I'm not really good at doing the washing up at home and wardrobe. So I don't know.
So ask your wife.
But not quite obsessive compulsive, I don't think.
Fair enough. So with dentistry and what you do, obviously aesthetics is a big part of what we see for you. What keeps you motivated? What keeps you passionate and producing these exceptional outcomes?
I just love it. You know, at 57, I just love it. I keep wondering when my the quality of my dentistry is going to drop off. Don't think it is at the moment, and I hope to keep it going for, you know, at least another 5 or 10 years. So
I have no doubt you've got at least that in you.
Maybe that's a challenge for me. You know, maybe it's I just want to keep on doing the next job better than the last one.
That process of self-assessment that started early on will continue pushing you through, perhaps.
Maybe.
So you also you give back a lot to the community with education. You started education, and pretty early on you said you had some of the best people in the world.
It's not necessarily giving back, although sometimes more than others, I guess. So, but anyway.
Tell us about your journey with CPD and we'll start with CEO Dental. It's a company that you run with Michael Mandakos and do some live events. Tell us about that because it had a very different beginning.
Very interesting story. So I guess in about 1998, 1999, it was soon after both Michael and I had returned home after our prosthodontic programs. And as you might remember, it was the very beginning of the internet. And Michael, this is a really weird and interesting story, but in about 1999, 6 of the 10 largest pornographic sites in the world were run out of Brisbane, Australia.
Really?
One of Michael's accountants was the accountant for 2 or 3 of these guys, and they were making ridiculous amounts of money, and this guy said to Michael, listen, you should get into this internet thing and, you know, maybe do something in dentistry. And so he approached me and said, look, why don't we put a couple of our lectures online and see if we can, you know, build some sort of educational site. And then I said to him, well, why would we, you know, no one wants to listen to our lectures. Why don't we tap a few of the people, you know, overseas on the shoulder and see if they'll be involved. So we found someone who could actually or said that they could put together a live lecture. And at that point, we were all using analog slides. So we had to scan people's slides and had to somehow film them and then coordinate the slides with their audio and video. And we developed with this person a kind of a way of doing that, which is very difficult at the time, given the you know, the amount of data that could travel through the lines at that particular period in time. So anyway, we put together a site. We actually produced the first live lectures in dentistry online in the world, and we probably had 20 or 30 people from overseas, quite famous people, who sort of helped us produce a few lectures to put online, and we operated on a subscription model. But the problem was that at that time, no one much was interested in subscribing to watch a lecture online in dentistry. It's a little bit different now. Anyway,
yeah, way too ahead of your time.
Yeah, as I said, a little bit too much. And so Michael and I really persisted with this idea. We put a lot of energy into it. We drove our respective partners and wives mad. And after that, we'd spent a bunch of money and not much money was coming in, and we just kind of let it slide, really. We'd sort of burnt out. Mm. And then a year or two after that, Michael said to me, maybe we should you know, do a few lectures ourselves and see if we can generate a little bit of cash and pay down some of this debt. And we did that, and I guess that's kind of what CEO Dental is now. So the first thing we did was we organized a couple of 2 and 3 day lectures, and then we put together the mini residency in prosthodontics, which is still going now.
Indeed.
And then later a mini residency in implant dentistry and a few other bits and pieces that we do.
All right. So there's a mini residency in implant dentistry already?
We ran it for 3 years, and we stopped last year because, you know, it was – like the mini residency in prosthodontics, you know, it pretty much books up a year in advance every year, but the dentistry one there was less interest in. So I think we're going to reinvent that as a series of modules that people can take individually rather than one 9-day program like the mini residency in prosthodontics. So at the moment, the mini residency in implant dentistry is in a state of evolution, I guess.
Yeah, okay. Well, that'd be interesting to hear where that ends up. You guys, in the early days, got a lot of famous people, you know, with CEO Dental when you're attempting to do the online thing. And nowadays, you've refined it, but you're still getting some big names out to Australia. You did that early on in your career as well. Do you think that's a really important thing to get that input, you know, outside of our Australian colleagues?
Yeah, for sure. The world's a big place, and I think in Australia the standards of dentistry are really very high, and there's a lot of great people to listen to. But the world is a big place, and our access to it is becoming easier and easier. So, you know, why wouldn't you seek information from outside? That's fundamental, and I think it's what people do more and more and more.
Yeah, definitely. And with social media, we're getting exposed to a lot more.
It's incredible.
For graduate dentists or students, graduates, early career dentists, obviously you've had a big impact on the CPD side of things. What do you think graduates are missing, and what do you think graduates should really focus on in their first couple of years?
That's a good question. I think start with getting the basics right, like being able to anaesthetize people comfortably and properly. Having good vision is really important. I think I see a lot of people find dentistry really difficult because they have a lot of trouble isolating a tooth, and I don't necessarily mean with rubber dam. It can be mm-hmm. with cotton rolls and mirrors and retractors, but, you know, just put yourself in the best place to visualize and see what you're doing. Try to do every task well. Like, personally, it's kind of weird, but I get as much of a kick out of doing an occlusal composite as I do out of, you know, placing an implant in a, you know, to replace a missing central incisor. So try to do every task reasonably well, I think, is a good thing to do. I think that, you know, now there is the potential to evolve really quickly, but I think it's wrong to try to evolve too quickly, because I think you can find yourself doing things that look simple online when you've seen a photograph or two or three. So just...
Tell us some specifics about that. Like, are you thinking implants, for instance? Are you thinking of full mouth rehab?
Implants, other things? Really, because I think it's really easy to make a mess of implants. So if I think of my own particular journey in implant dentistry, you know, it started with a PROS program and learning a lot about implants in general, specifically the restorative aspects of implants. And then I would attend, you know, every surgery, you know, probably for a 5 or 6 year period to watch the surgeons place my implant, never with the intention of placing implants myself at the time. But ultimately, I got to a point where I started to become interested in placing them. So then I started to do some relatively, you know, some simpler surgical procedures, like maybe a little bit of crown lengthening in cases that weren't critical, maybe some little connective tissue grafts and ridge augmentations in little edentulous sites. Then I started to place implants in relatively straightforward situations. Let's say a missing premolar, perhaps something like that. Maybe a missing molar where there wasn't any anatomical structure in the way. And I don't think you can seriously entertain placing implants in the aesthetic zone without really comprehensive grafting skills. So I think you need to develop those skills before you start placing those. And I think the stuff that you would avoid the most would be anything in the aesthetic zone. I think it's really easy to come undone in that area. If you come undone somewhere else, it's not going to turn into a legal disaster. And so for me, that process was probably an 8-year process where I was only stepping into the next stage after I was confident with the preceding stage. And, you know,
I think that's really good advice.
Different to my journey, but I would recommend my journey.
Yeah, well, you obviously, if you're building on a solid foundation, when you get to those harder, complex cases, you're going to see what could go wrong.
Yeah.
And you're going to navigate that in a much wiser way. Implants are obviously the key one in that regard. Are there any other things that you see graduates stepping into? Potentially, I guess, in the pros area, you may see some referrals of cases where you think perhaps a clinician wasn't experienced enough or educated enough or did not see what was going to go wrong.
You mentioned full mouth rehabs, and I guess that's an obvious one. It can seem so simple, you know, to prepare a bunch of teeth and get an impression and send it off to the lab. But I think to do that type of case properly, you don't have to be a genius, but it does require you can do it better if you have sufficient knowledge and you have some experience and you've maybe tried some simpler cases first.
For the listeners who when you say simpler, can you explain that in a bit of detail? So, for instance, what are those big red flag cases where you think, well, that's just no way, probably pros only kind of case? What's a case where you think, well, look, if you're going to get into that after having the foundations right, this is the style of case you might do first?
The first thing I'd say is I don't look at many cases and think a general practitioner shouldn't do that case. I'm generally looking at a case and asking myself whether I could do the case. I don't know. I guess any case where you're making a big change to someone's occlusion, that's probably any case where you're going to alter vertical dimension. There's a certain amount of knowledge that's required to work out what vertical dimension you're going to work to, what occlusal scheme you're going to develop. Again, that doesn't have to be very confident, but it's still a decision that you need to that doesn't have to be very complex, but it's still a decision that you have to make. And then in the end, how you're going to combine those two things and have the patient look good as well, because in the end that might be the thing that the patient cares about more than anything. And putting those three things together, it's like most things, it might not be so difficult when you know how, but it's easy to come unstuck before you know how to do that. So I think they're not the sort of cases that you would just step into. In fact, that there's a case I saw posted on Facebook recently where someone was asking for some advice about a case, and it looked like a really difficult case. And the chances are, if you're asking for advice on Facebook, you're not in a great position to manage that type of case.
This should be the first red flag.
I think it's a red flag, yeah. So I'm not, I mean, obviously I'm involved in teaching people how to manage those more complex cases, and this isn't a sell for those courses. The point I want to make is I'm not saying that you shouldn't do those cases. I'm saying that somehow, some way, you should be taking serious steps to educate yourself before you start doing those cases.
Yeah, and build your foundations and grow that base before you get into that stuff. That's pretty wise advice. I love to ask this question, and I want you to think about your career and where you're at now. I want you to think about if you could go back and tell yourself something just after graduation around that time, and something that would change your career, maybe accelerate to where you are, or something that would help you. What are the things you would tell yourself when you were graduating?
Goodness, that's so tricky. Firstly, I'm reasonably happy with how my career proceeded. Like, it kind of...
That's good to hear.
Evolved gradually, and I'm happy with that. But I guess the sooner you educate yourself after dental school, the more rapidly you can progress. So, you know, we often get, and once again, this isn't a sell, but people in their first and second year of graduation often say to me or Michael, you know, is it too early to do the mini residency in prosthodontics, for example? And I don't think it is. I think it's true to say that you would get more out of it if you were in your fifth year of graduation, and you would get more out of it if you were in your 10th year after graduation. But by the same token, in the first or second year after graduation, it's going to accelerate your position to a certain point. And it might be that you need to do it again 3 years later to really get the full benefit out of it, but you're still going to move ahead more rapidly. So the point I want to make is that the sooner you identify your own areas of interest, whether they're endodontics, orthodontics, restorative dentistry, whatever, jump into education because dental school is it's just the start.
Absolutely. It really is just the start. And if you invest in yourself, you can take those steps forward much, much quicker. That's good advice. This question ties very closely into that as well. And I think it's more, I want you to think about the graduates that are coming out right now and perhaps thinking about what you see that might be a problem or not. But if you could get in the ear of every single graduate in Australia or in the world and really teach them something or have them understand a concept that you feel may be missing, what do you think people are missing as they graduate?
Look, I'm really big on those basics of shape and colour. And I don't think they're especially well taught at dental school, and I don't think there are too many patients that walk into any dental practice in the country that don't want their teeth to look reasonably good.
Mm.
Understanding shape and colour is really fundamental. So this idea of understanding morphology and becoming a little bit obsessed with it and understanding why teeth look the way they look. So, but obviously I'm coming from a particular orientation and focus. You know, if I was an endodontist, I'd probably be, you know, talking about how to manage trauma or something. But, you know, maybe that would be my small contribution to that.
Well, that's certainly what I'm going to take from this.
Good. Thank you.
So, Tony, I really appreciate you spending your time with us this afternoon and sharing your insights, your story and your views on quite a lot of things. I know you don't want to, you know, it's not a sell for your CEO Dental, but I do want to just let everyone know that you do courses. You do these with Michael Mandakos through CEO Dental, and you lecture in a few different ways around the world, internationally, actually. I've seen some of your lectures and we've all seen a lot of your work on Facebook, and it's exceptional. So I recommend people do check it out. I appreciate your time, Tony. Thank you very much.
My absolute pleasure. Thank you for bothering to ask me to be interviewed. It's an absolute pleasure. I hope there's someone out there that might even listen to it.
I have no doubt. Thanks.
Thanks.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Tony Rotondo. It's so good to hear someone's story who is so influential in the Australian dental community. I found it really interesting when he's talking about shape and colour and learning morphology of teeth to really understand where you're trying to get to with your restorations. It's definitely something I'm going to work on and do a waxing course or do courses around that. On the Dental Head Start blog, I recently wrote about being mentored, and I think this is something that's pretty important. If you want to be mentored, everyone's looking for it. They want mentorship in their new job or their first job, but the onus is on you. You need to be able to facilitate that relationship and allow your mentor to help you and make it easy for them. So I wrote a few tips about that on the blog. I'd love to hear your thoughts on that. You can find it on the website. You can find it on the Facebook page. And if you are enjoying this, check out our website, dentalheadstart.com. You can subscribe to the email list. You can find us on Facebook, like us there. And of course, on Instagram, we'd appreciate if you follow. And most of all, we'd appreciate if you'd share any of this content with people you think might benefit from it. And lastly, I want to say thank you to all the listeners out there. It's great to see the listener numbers increasing each time we release an episode. and I really hope it is helping people. It really gives me pleasure to try to help graduates transition from dental school into private practice. So thank you for listening, thank you for sharing, and thank you for your feedback. For now, we'll catch you next episode.